reopen the Committee on Transportation, and sorry for the delay, but it was quick, so that's good. We have Ms. Taylor here from the Rail Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I think we will begin with your testimony, and then as others straggle back in, they're probably at some switching hub right now, having the difficulty aggregating to come down the line and back into the committee. So we'll begin with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Tater with the Department of Transportation Rail Division. And what I've got in my testimony today is a snapshot in time assessment that I did in December for the governor and for my director. You know, there's been a number of short line issues from the Coos Bay embargo, a potential abandonment outside of Corvallis with the Lower West Side Bailey Branch, the Port of Tillamook Bay, just different things happening. And they said, Kelly, can you please put together an assessment, high level, of our short lines and what their conditions are so we have some sort of idea of what's out there. So what you've got in front of you is that. Now, I just want to walk you through some things you've already heard. The short lines came from spun-off lines from Class 1s. These were redundant lines that the Class 1s did not want to maintain. They were typically low business density and had very little maintenance done through the last several years. So when the short lines took them on in a very entrepreneurial spirit, they were taking on something that didn't have much business and was probably in poor condition. Well, unless you can generate enough business to cover two things, both operations, that's your running of the business, and maintenance, investments in the line, and this is a very capital-intensive business, it's just a matter of time before you're not going to be able to offer service, and that's what we're starting to see. And the issue that you have in Oregon is happening across the country. This is not unique to our state. It's all short lines are facing this. They are, if they don't have enough business, enough carloads, enough new business to generate both operations and maintenance, they're simply depleting down the residual value of the line they inherited. So with that, we looked at business viability, and there are certain conditions. And on page 2, I'm leading to the matrix. There's some annual carloads per mile predictors of viability. I won't walk that through, walk you through it. You can read it, but it's talking about certain number of carloads per mile, maybe a good chance, maybe not a good chance. And the issues that I looked at when I put this matrix together, my staff and I, were track the infrastructure itself, either what conditions it in, what classification it is, how good of condition it is. I know you're all familiar with roads and hearing about pavement being fair or better and things. Well, in the rail world, it's classifications, numbers. And there's 1 through 9, and the higher the number, the faster the speed, the more beefy your system is. The lower the number, the slower you have to go, and the worse condition it is. Most of our short lines are accepted, which is a very, very, very lowest. It's not even on the number radar screen. 1 and 2. And accepted in 1, you can only run 10 miles an hour. And Class 2, you can run 25. Now, sometimes they actually call themselves accepted. It's the prerogative of the railroad to run it as accepted. And in that case, it gets them out of a lot of the FRA regulations about track condition and what they must maintain it as, but it makes them have to run at a lower speed. But they're willing to do that because they may not have the dollars that it would take to keep it at a Class 2 level being regulated. So they tend to either have it all really run down to accepted level or run it at that. Then the other piece is whether or not that track, and this is on page 3, is heavy enough rail in a 3-foot swath, and that's when they talk about heavy rail, and they say it's 90-pound rail or 110-pound rail. They're talking about in a 3-foot length, how heavy is that rail? And to run the standard cars, rail cars that are 286,000 pounds, they get called 286 for short, you need at least 110-pound rail. Preferably, it'd be heavier than that, 133 and above, but you need at least 110. Of the rail miles in Oregon, 20% are less than 90-pound rail. So they're inadequate for really, truly running 286. Now, I will tell you, some short lines have very light rail, maybe 75, 90-pound rail, and they're running 286, but they're doing very carefully and at great risk. They break their rail, it gets brittle, they have derailments. It's not a safe thing to do, but they'll do it because they're trying to keep in business. To upgrade a mile of track to get it to 286 is estimated to be about $250,000 to $300,000. So upgrading the Oregon track that currently is not to the heavier rail to do 286 would be somewhere between $125 and $150 million, just to give you an idea of just that issue alone. Now, just like on highways, aging bridges and tunnels, you've already heard about this a little bit. Same issue. The tunnels in Oregon, There are 69 of them in the rail system. Over about half of them are on the short line. And they were dug, all but one of them, were dug between 1883 and 1916. And so, as you know, that means that most of them are over 100 years old. And, yes, they've had some maintenance, but the overall structure, the wooden ribs and things are there. We live in a wet climate, as we all know. Wood doesn't last forever, even in a dry climate, so they're starting to decay. That's why we're starting to have issues. That's the issue in the Coos Bay line. Bridges, similar to the highway issue with OTIA 3 when you did an infusion because our highway bridges are getting old, the rail bridges are getting old. We have hundreds and hundreds of rail bridges in the state of different sizes. The one on the chart that I'm going to walk you through, we looked at how many bridges on each line were over 100 feet long. We looked at the bigger bridges. But most of them were built in the 40s and 50s, or last time really some maintenance work was on, big structural changes. And they, too, are mostly wooden, not concrete and steel. It's the same problem. And as noted in a recent federal report just of last summer in Oregon, they came out and visited Oregon and some other states, there are no Federal Railroad Administration regulations about tunnels and bridges, about standards. It's left to the railroads to inspect them and to maintain them. That's interesting because of the things that are regulated by the FRA, Federal Railroad, it's safety issues. But for some reason, at this point, tunnels and bridges, they do not have standards. They're not part of the regulations. So we really don't have, what that means is, I've got folks that go out and inspect track, walk the track. Yes, we look at bridges and tunnels as far as the walk space around trains and clearances, that's something by state law, but we don't truly inspect the bridges and tunnels like we would a track. So I don't have good inventory data. That's one of the things in the study that we will do. That's the big gap of information about the rail system is the condition. Not so much on the Class 1 system. I mean, it's all about short lines. They pretty much have the wherewithal about their system. But the short line operators simply don't, and they don't have the money or the time to be able to do it or the expertise. So, going on. Now, rail funding, I mentioned that this is capital intensive. 18 to 20% of their business, their revenue goes back into infrastructure. It's extremely expensive. Steel keeps going up. The ties get more expensive. It is an expensive business. There have been funding that's been invested, public funding, some of it from the congressional delegation, some of it from the Oregon legislature, $4 million total to the short line rehabilitation account, $8 million in rail spurs, and I will tell you that of the Connect 1 $100 million, about $29 million went towards projects that benefit the short line system. So they did compete well during the Connect Oregon 1. Now, I want to take you to the crux of the matter, and that's the part of my testimony, and that is this assessment that I did, and I want to just walk you through the chart. I know it's tiny print, but to try to get it on the page is what I had to do. But I just want to walk you across so you'll know what you're looking at. Let's take this bottom one here. So it's got Central Oregon and Pacific, and then reading from left to right, numbers of miles leased or owned, their gross revenue from 2006, this is the last full year data I have, revenue per mile, carloads, and carloads per mile. Now, remember when I had on page 2 the predictability of business viability, okay, predictors. If you're probably over 100 carloads per mile, probably pretty good chances you're going to succeed as a small railroad. And that's under normal conditions. Now, the thing about some of our railroads, particularly like Port of Tillamook Bay and the Coos Bay Line, the terrain they go through isn't exactly normal. Very, you know, they've got a lot of curves, they've got a lot of mountains, they've got steep grades, a lot of wet. So it takes more even than a normal situation would for maintenance. But if you can see, they have 117 carloads per mile for the whole corp system, not just the Coos Bay Line. I've got some breakdown there. How many tunnels they have? 20 tunnels total, 100 bridges over 100 feet long, and what's their class? Class accepted, 1 and 2, so it's a mix. How many miles of rail are less than 110 pounds? 51, almost 52 miles. Are they handling 286? Yes. And then off to the very far right, I've got some comments that we put together, just my staff and I looking at what we knew to be able to put down in this snapshot of time. This was done in December or so. It was, you know, what we know about it. Now, when we had branch lines within a short line, we put the information here. And on Corp, I did have it. So you've got the Siskiyou Line, the Coos Bay Line, the White City Branch. Look at the Coos Bay branch. Read that across. It's 137 miles. Carloads per mile, 43 carloads per mile. That's not very much business to be able to sustain that kind of rail line. So it's showing you that it's pretty anemic, or excuse me, yeah. 43, yeah. It's kind of on the anemic side for being able to generate enough for both operations and maintenance. But overall, they do pretty good. But inside the rail world, subsidy is not necessarily from one branch to another a good thing to do. They really try to have each branch make it or break it on their own. And we may look at it differently, and that's maybe something we can talk about, but overall, they do pretty good. Individual branches, one may do better than the other. And yes, this one over here may make enough to help this one, but they typically don't like to do that. They want each one to do their own. So that's, Mr. Chair, I'm going to conclude with that. That's what I put together here. It's a snapshot in time. I will tell you that with the money that was allocated to do the rail portion of the multimodal study and everything last session, we just are in the process of awarding the RFP. I have hired someone. Well, I didn't hire someone. Someone's rotating over. I don't have enough. I'm hiring someone's rotating over to help me direct it. We are going to look at the tunnels, the bridges. We're going to make that money go as far as we can to get as much work as we can get done. We want to look at the class one business model, the emerging trends, and how you mitigate it, whether it's, you know, regional hubs or something. Funding mechanisms, because you have some good policy in the books today, on the books today, about acquiring, maintaining, et cetera, rail lines, and you've got some accounts set up. One of them, the State Rail Rehabilitation Funds, never had money put in it, but it's there. But we need to find some funding mechanisms that you could consider if you wanted to make rail investments, what sort of revenue streams might help you ongoing. And we're going to look across the country to see what everybody's done, both passenger and freight, bring them forth. There may be some models that don't work here. There may be some that you don't like. But I'll at least give you the information so you can make some decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On our Connect or One grants, mm-hmm. Did we have a default on one of the rail grants of about $1.7 million? That has been returned or will not be
Mr. Chair, there have been a couple of. There was a small one where we never reached agreement. The short line decided they did not want to enter into the agreement. Some of the provisions, you know, the bonds are good for 20 years, and so we're trying to make sure the project's going to be a, you know, lifespan of 20 years, et cetera. And they weren't sure, so they backed off. That was very small. And then, yeah, there was one over in the Ontario area that we ended up withdrawing because they just didn't have the financial pieces put together to make the project happen.
And those monies that would have been allocated to that, what are we doing with those monies currently?
They were reallocated to the project that was next in line that the commission had approved the previous summer.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your report, Ms. Taylor. I am hopeful, and I believe that this is the case, that the rail study is not just going to look at the baseline condition, but is also going to try to make recommendations as well. And let me be specific about what I'm thinking. I know that on the short line that goes through my district, there are a number of private crossings that have presented enormous liability concerns. They inhibit speed. There are lots of issues with them. Are you going to be looking at issues that narrow and making any recommendations, or are you just trying to assess the condition of the system?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, private crossings currently are outside of our authority, other than to try to get an agreement for the property owner to, if it's something that, you know, we have on that particular line. They're outside of our authority, so probably no, the study would not look at private crossings.
Maybe I could nuance my question a little bit better. The second part of my question was to ask, in cases where existing studies have occurred, and I'm thinking specifically the very proactive look that the city of Scappoose took under the leadership of John Hankin to look at rail through the city, whether or not those existing pieces that were done by very reputable consultants can be in some way incorporated into your rail plan. And what causes me to think about all of this was that study actually looked at private crossings, and even though you have no regulatory authority, it was a recommendation that came out of that study that I think the railroads embraced. And we closed a private crossing as a result and then put a gated crossing in for a much higher degree of safety. And I just was trying to get a sense of to what degree your study is going to be making not specific crossing recommendations, but more global recommendations about how to wring more efficiency out of the lines that we have.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I think that there will be some recommendations come out of it. I don't know to what degree yet because I'm still waiting to see exactly how much it's going to cost in different work products. I believe that just doing the assessment, from what I understand, just doing the assessments of tunnels and bridges is going to eat up a good chunk of the money I have. What my goal is to try to give you an assessment of what you have, not we, like we own it, but what Oregon has in their rail system, how it's being used, where it's going in the future, both in terms of commodity and flow and business models, and then funding mechanisms that once you know what you've got, where its pinch points are, which may be private crossings. I don't know how far down, but that's an example. Where your pinch points are, some funding mechanisms for you then to choose. If we have revenue stream, this is what we could address with it, and this is where it makes sense to do that. Now, some of that will come out of the piece I'm doing, and some of that will then come out of the bigger freight plan that covers all modes. So I'm going to be gathering some data that's going into that.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, and I appreciate your report very much. In reference to the Coos Bay line, as well as the Siskiyou line, there has been a coalition of shippers that have organized, and you probably have seen that list, and it's quite broad. Mm-hmm. And in your report, I noticed on the Siskiyou line, while you show that there were carloads actually going on that line in 06, you show no revenue. Was that the case? There was no revenue?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, thank you for letting me explain this. It's a good question. We do get annual reports from each railroad for their system, and so they don't give us revenue broke down per line. It's their entire system. So the revenue dollar you see is for all of Corp's system. We just happen to have some carload information because of the recent issues that have been going on, so we went ahead and included it. But we typically do not get carloads per branch lines within a particular short line. We get the global picture.
I thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I thank you very much for that comment. I just want to raise the issue, and while you're talking about statewide and the future and what we need to do with rail, I just want to lift to you the horrible economic impact that has happened in the Corp line with the embargo. I don't think it can be overstated or overstressed. Those four companies are paying 15% more by having to truck, and they're not trucking all of it as it is. And I just fear we are going to lose American Bridge if we're not able to do something. They settled on Bolin Island because of the rail access, and so I just want to lift that up to you while I have an opportunity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I appreciate that, and I truly understand. I hear that from some of the other areas, too. Not everyone's going to have their business located along the I-5 perfectly, nor should they have to. And we need to find a way to make some policy decisions like the Chair has been saying. Me give you information so you can make policy decisions about how to use those policies you already have about acquiring, maintaining, where to make some public investment if the private dollars aren't enough to keep it going. Where do we do it? And hopefully the information I'll be able to gather for you will give you those options so that you can make those decisions in order to keep those communities going.
Other questions from Ms. Taylor? Senator Starr.
Thank you. I've got a question. You know, and there's maybe not a typical answer, but typically, what's the width of a railroad right-of-way?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, you're right. There's not a typical. It can range anywhere from 50 feet to 100 feet, but that'd be the too common.
But it's significantly 60 to 100. It's significantly wider than a single railroad track.
Correct.
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest, you know, we're talking about spending public dollars on private infrastructure, and I'm fine with that, particularly if there's the public good to be served. But, and this is probably issues that are more federally regulated, unfortunately, but they may not be. In return for those public dollars that we're spending on private right of way, we've got a lot of controversy in this state. It seems like every time I turn around about running a pipeline here or some other infrastructure that ends up getting buried in the ground, I would just suggest that there might be a way to use this already in the already identified right of way for as a trade-off, as a trade for this donation in public dollars. You don't have to comment on that if you don't want to, but I wanted to throw it out there. I'm sure the railroads would love that. But on the other hand, they are coming to the state and coming to the federal government and asking for public dollars. And, you know, we've got a gas line that's a big controversy coming across southern Washington County and other counties, but there ought to be some opportunity there. So I'm just throwing it out there.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Kelly, as we look at, you know, policies and try to, as you are doing, you know, making assessments of the infrastructure status, I go back to what Ms. Lundberg was testifying to about, you know, looking at strategic locations for multimodal centers, hubs and nodes. And part of the calculation, I think is critical, is looking at what can be done in terms of providing business opportunities as part of that modeling, besides just the infrastructure. You know, we heard Mr. Finn talk about, you know, we can't build it on the, we build it and hope they come. But certainly, I think as a state, we do assessments all the time, and OECDD seems to be doing assessments all the time, hiring consultants about, you know, prospective business opportunities and in certain clusters of industries, and then how do we help facilitate that, and nanotech, and, you know, this committee in particular has dealt with a lot of, you know, if we build this, they will come type of philosophies. And I think we can transfer this, and I think it's part of the responsibility is to transfer that also to our infrastructure and try to model how we help generate the activity that the Class 1 railroads then, based on, as they explain to us their modeling, say, yeah, this makes business sense to us if you can do those things. And I use, for example, like we talk about Coos Bay. We've been dealing with Vanel Farms and you know, the biggest grower we have in the western part of this state and other types of industries, that if we had certain infrastructure, you know, can we go out and assess the likelihood of increased business activity that would be then rail that would look at using rail service if some of these things were there, so that we can help actually make a business case to some of our rail partners, like this, for example, the Class 1s, where we could lure certain types of businesses because of the opportunity to have some of these hubs. And again, they're not going to be able to utilize a service that doesn't exist, but I think we need to assess how many of those may take advantage of growth and development in their businesses if, in fact, you know, we put on a marker that we were going to try and provide the aggregation that would be necessary to make everybody's business be successful. And, I mean, I think that's just another part of it. We're talking about assessing the quality of existing lines and what it takes to move them up. But I think we also need to assess how do we provide more opportunity to make those potentially improve lines viable for everyone. And we make investments, like I say, in all these other economic areas to try and bring business that we think would come if they knew they had an opportunity to be successful. And so I think we need to somehow move this, the economic discussion, in so that when we have areas that are, if there's 60 cars or 70 cars, you know, how do we as a state also look at investments in an area that would help generate those 110 and those 120, those 120 cars that then make the rest of the system work. And I don't think that would be necessarily just your division, but I think your division in partnership with some of our economic arms of the state, I think would be an important work that we could do to see how we can make this all work. Because we have heard what it takes for these things to be successful. And so part of it is some type of realistic expectation of how we might be able to lure those types of businesses. Because one of the things that, you know, I've been very concerned about, and I know a number of you have served on the committee with me for a number of sessions now on the business side of our committee that we have done, is that we are spending a lot of money, spending a lot of time, and I think rightfully so, trying to maintain businesses, trying to grow businesses, trying to bring businesses to Oregon, but lack for transportation, whether it's rail or trucking, and all of a sudden we lose 200 jobs, we lose 500 jobs, all of a sudden they're not going to grow grain in the valley now because they can't. Well, that you know, that is counterproductive to everything else we're trying to do if we can't maintain and grow our existing economic base. And so, I mean, I think this is really does rise to a high level. I think it's a you know, a governor's level of, in terms of pushing for economic growth means maintaining the opportunities that we have now. Because if we can't provide rail service because it's too expensive for a company in Coos Bay, and then another major company like an American Bridge leaves because now they don't have the opportunity, and you have this domino effect, that's much more significant than any of the economic growth that we've been expending on the other way. So, I don't expect necessarily an answer to that, but I think we need to look at economic modeling for how do we make this stuff more productive, as well as how do we make it more the physical infrastructure more viable itself. I just think that's a combination we need to work together better on.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, could I just reemphasize what you're saying? Because the day of the embargo, the press release had been written by American Bridge to add 18 new jobs to that company, and those 18 jobs were immediately pulled back. Southport moved to the North Spit because they had a rail spur. So I think what you're saying is exactly right.
Kelly.
Mr. Chair, I think you make some really good points, and the word you used at the end was the word I was thinking as you were talking, and that it's a combination of things because, and as you were talking, I thought, yeah, and it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg thing because you have to keep what you have in place begin with, because it's sort of your base foundation. But you know, you might want to add a bathroom onto the house, but if you've got a bad foundation, you may not want to. So you have to keep the foundation of the roof going first before you remodel it and add some other room. And it's a little bit like that, and the railroads can speak to it much better than I can, but you know, it isn't that they don't want new business, because they do. And that's why you heard Mr. Carswell talk about looking for those opportunities like the Teevan one that he talked about. So you want that. On the other hand, you got to make sure that what you take on, your infrastructure can support. For example, he's got the issue up on the Columbia line. If Senator Johns was here, she would know this for sure. Those unit trains are coming in of corn from the east to make ethanol at Port Westward is wonderful, but that track that he's got to carry it over is not going to be good enough to hold up very long. With unit trains, it'll break down, and he's not ready with money to infuse. So it's, you know, you have to do that. Now, on the other hand, so the class ones and everything will say, yes, you can bring on business, but we've got to make sure we've got the capacity to handle it. So it isn't just bring it on. It's build capacity, keep your infrastructure, and, as you were saying, make some of those, if we build it, will they come sort of things. Now, they may not want to put their dollars in it. They're saying that's not, for them on Wall Street, they can't get there with their boards and the way that they are. But the state may want to do that. And I do work closely with Economic Development Department, OECD. I did with the Industrial Rail Spurs as we were evaluating projects. We looked around with them to say, you know, is this a real one? Is that a real one? And for the most part, it panned out. One of them, it did not. It had been something going, and we finally just had to withdraw it because at this point, that dog wasn't going to hunt. You know, we get there eventually. So we had to pull back so we could look around, you know, to use the money somewhere else. But the word you said, the balancing, it isn't all just keep your infrastructure going, but that's a good piece of it. Yes, I think you're right. You have to look around opportunity and grow. And with economic development, we've talked about it. Even if the rail spur is there, you can't assume you're going to have service. And, you know, there was a business, PepsiCo was going to build this huge plant down in the Albany area, figured they're going to have rail service because it's right there. And about the time the ink was drying, everybody went, well, what do you mean we don't get rail service? Well, you hadn't even talked to the railroad to even see if they could afford to stop and take your stuff and, you know, work out all the deals and everything. Because in some ways, the lines are like our interstates and it's access management. They don't want a bunch of driveways hooked to it because it won't work for them for throughput. So, you know, we're working it all out. So what I've learned with economic development is as they have these shovel-ready sites and they're busy marketing them for businesses, be careful that you don't overpromise something that you haven't talked to the railroads about, because they have to be able to look at it and see if it fits in their model too. And we had the same problem with a big project up that would have been in Porto Moro at the time. Capacity just wasn't there. Union Pacific said, you can build it, but we can't take you on right now. We simply can't. Things have changed. Now they're saying we've got some capacity. You know, things are down. It may happen. So you're absolutely right, Mr. Chair. You have to do both. You can't just do the one. I totally agree with you, but it is a balance.
Mr. Martin, sorry for the interruption.
No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and along with Cindy Robert, I have the pleasure of representing the Union Pacific Railroad. The testimony in front of you was written by Brock Nelson, who's our new public relations person for the state of Oregon and Washington, and will be headquartered in Portland. He's in Omaha today, can't be here. Some of you have met him, and I want to make sure all of you do shortly. You may find the second paragraph a little strange to talk about safety of employees and neighbors, but I have attended numerous railroad meetings. Every single meeting starts with an announcement from the chairman that safety in the building is number one question. The exit is here. The exit out of the building is there. We have CPR. We have, and they go through this safety because the railroads are just bent over backwards to emphasize safety in the whole operation of the system because it's a big, huge industrial system and can be dangerous if you're not thinking about it. The Union Pacific has gone through a major overhaul in its corporate outreach in the last few months, and Brock Nelson is now in Oregon, and there are people similar to him in other states all over. They're decentralizing out of Omaha and putting people out who can answer questions, and that's extremely important because a huge company, communications are as difficult as they are with the federal government. To get an answer sometimes takes a long time. Just involving Brock Nelson in this is going to bring answers far quicker for the state, for the legislature, for our customers. I think it's very important. The Union Pacific Railroad is, at least I could have said this a month ago, the largest operating system in the state of Oregon. With the outage we have on the Willamette Pass, I'll get to it a bit, we're putting a lot of our system onto the BNSF, and which brings me to a point I need to emphasize to you. The two railroads are competitors. We are the two largest railroads in the world. We compete with each other, not as much in Oregon as they do in other parts of the system, because we don't have parallel systems in Oregon, and we cooperate a lot more than we fight with or compete with each other. And with the outage on the Willamette Pass, which is a huge, huge problem, we've lost something over 1,000 feet of not just a overflow of rock, stone, and timber, but a washout of the entire line. We're spending millions of dollars to rebuild that. We've put every bit of effort into it. Terry Finn mentioned earlier that when railroads face an emergency, they rally very quickly. We've done that in the most severe weather conditions that you could possibly imagine. It snowed 8-10 feet in the Willamette Pass where we're struggling. We have 15 freight trains a day that go through there, and in addition, we've knocked Amtrak out. Five of those 15 trains are diverted up through Bend on the BNSF system to the Dalles or to the Columbia River and then down into Portland. The other 10 are going from Sacramento to Salt Lake and then back on our system from the east. It's added one day of shipping time, but we're keeping the system operating, and we couldn't have done that without the cooperation of the BNSF. We have joint track sharage on Highway 97 from down into California. They use our system from Portland to Seattle. We operate jointly on tracks, so there's a lot of cooperation. The Union Pacific Railroad spends $3 billion plus per year on capital construction. That's private dollars. And it's important you understand the context of that. That's 20% of our gross revenues. No other industry anywhere in this country spends anything close to that of their gross revenue. We need to spend more than that, and we literally cannot. We're prevented by Wall Street and by the stock market. Our investors would rebel, and our stock would plummet if we spent more than 20% of our revenues. We need to spend more. There is a way to go about this. I've talked to some of you about it. The federal government considered a bill in the last session to give tax credits for additional spending. They may consider it again. I would love to have, and I talked to Senator Starr about this, I'd love to have the NCSL consider the issue of encouraging the federal government to pass that legislation. It's supported by all the short lines and all the railroads in the country. It would just put more investment into the properties. In Oregon, we've spent $330 million in the last 5 years. That's a tremendous amount of capital investment. About 40% of that has been on, or half of that has been on the I-5 corridor. And we know, we've worked with ODOT, We know that ODOT would like us to be able to take more traffic, the truck traffic, off of I-5 corridor. The trucking industry would like us to do that. We're all trying to find a way to accomplish that. And I don't have to tell any of you that drive I-5 that we seem to have maxed out on the amount of trucks that can be on that road. There's barely room, as Dave Barrows has said several times. It's two lanes for the trucks and one for us in case if they don't pass. And I was going around the curve on I-5 yesterday going up into Portland, and where it says all trucks take the truck route over, and a guy moved out a truck from Minnesota into the inside lane and went around that curve where he wasn't supposed to be. And I just thought to myself, you know, all you need is one truck accident there and it ties the entire system up. It's at least if we have a derailment on the railroad, we don't stop all traffic that's going on. I mentioned the cooperation. I think you need to understand part of the reason that Brock Nelson is coming here. The Union Pacific Railroad sees in Oregon a partner who wants to do something. Kelly Taylor has a great deal to do that. I could mention two things that have led to him coming here. One's Kelly Taylor, the other is the existence of O-Rule. We have an atmosphere where we're starting to consider problems and attack them intelligently. Kelly is the best person that's ever been in that division, and she understands. She's taken the time. She didn't have that experience. She's taken the time to learn how the railroads operate, what we can and cannot do, and she's willing to work with us. She can be critical of us. That's her role, but she can also try to come to you and suggest, here's some things we ought to do. Just from a historical standpoint, I think stop for a minute and realize Lewis and Clark came to Oregon via the Columbia River. The first pioneers came here and used the Columbia River, but they came in wagon trains. The next major form of transportation was the rails built after the Civil War. And how were they built? Well, there was government subsidy. They gave those railroads land in order to build the lines. And before somebody says, well, you got all that land, don't ask us for any more, that investment was used about 100 years ago. We don't have, for the most part, any of those lands, and it was a subsidy that was necessary to build the lines. The railroad industry nationwide continued to expand until about 80 years ago. And the high point, Kelly told me, was probably 1927, when it was the greatest number of trackage miles in the United States. And since that time, we have atrophied. We are going backwards. My father spent a career in the scrap business. It's been mentioned, Sam Schnitzer. My father knew him and worked with him personally. My father's business was buying rail and taking it out and shipping it somewhere else. Most of the communities in this state were connected by rail, and many of those are no longer connected. Those of us who grew up in the Portland area remember driving around in southeast Portland, down in the Pearl, all through the Northwest. There were sidings that went all over Portland, warehouses after block of warehouses with railroad sidings. The Pearl's there, and there aren't any railroad sidings left. Those have been taken out, and we've gone to these multiple points where you collect the rail. That's left some people irritated. There are people that, you know, I always used to have a car delivered right to my warehouse, and now you make me go somewhere else. That's just a fact of life that we have to understand. And I think we've arrived at the point, finally, where the atrophy in the railroad system is coming to a halt, and now we've got to figure out how to expand again. We have to repair those lines, and we, the Union Pacific Railroad, is solidly behind anything that we can do to help the short lines, because 50% or more of our freight originates on those short lines, and we want them to be able to move quickly and interface with us. The competition, you know, it's come from the trucking industry, from the fact that we built interstate freeways. We poured a lot of money, federal and state dollars, into subsidizing roads and airports. And I represent Alaska Airlines, so I'm not here to criticize that. But just stop and think of all the money we poured into the development through World War II, the building of the bombers that suddenly were converted to airliners and air freight. The federal government subsidized a lot of that. Not much subsidization has gone into the railroads. And I'm not sure we want huge grants. We've got to figure out a way to make this work better, and especially to help the short lines. One of the things I would really recommend to this committee is that you take the time during this interim to really spend considerable time on the subject of railroads. And one of the best ways to do that is make a day in Portland and have the Port of Portland put it on, because we all converge at the Port of Portland. And go see. Railroads are not the things you can see from the highway. You've got to get back in the background to look at them. And this, I went on this with Brock Nelson about a month ago. You learn a heck of a lot about how this infrastructure works if you just go see it. And I encourage you to do that. Maybe we also should have a day when we go to Southern Oregon and look at both the Coos Bay and the other problems down in Southern Oregon. We're interested in helping where we can. Let's all be cooperative, and let's really put some emphasis on setting this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Martin. And that's a very good idea, and we will work to schedule something this summer when the days are longer and have an opportunity to ride the rails a little bit in some of these key areas. I also do appreciate Mr. Nelson, and a few of you have had a chance to meet Brock Nelson. He's an engineer actually by trade, who actually worked in the rail business as a line person and moved up through the ranks and is now in the public relations side. But he came from the working side of the railroad and really understands it, and I've really enjoyed meeting him, and I think he is very, very committed to doing things. And I think your comments are also particularly valuable in terms of trying to work together to come up with common solutions. When you think of the stand that our state has made and the country has made, for example, on greenhouse emissions and the comparison between, trucks and rail, are pretty clear. Talk about trying to reduce usage of fossil fuels and the cost of fuel for running the rail. I mean, these meet significant state goals. When you try to look at the cost, when you can have the aggregation for the people doing business and trying to be competitive, the rail, in those types of cases. And as a committee, we're working on our highway infrastructure and maintaining good transportation infrastructure for trucks and freight. When we know we have increasing truck traffic and, less availability for that, when we can take some of those off the road so that others can move more freely when we know they're increasing. I mean, it just meets everything, and it really is incumbent on us to try and work together. And one thing that I feel, and I know the committee feels, is would be really, really good is, from these days forward, with especially with all the issues we face, if Oregon can demonstrate real leadership on how short lines and class ones and economic development and transportation of the state can work together and show other folks how we can get some things done and mutually benefit. I mean, that's what we want to do. It meets everybody's goals if we can be successful. And we want to be a player in that, and we want a positive player in making those things happen. Senator Larry George.
Thank you. I actually want to ask a question of Kelly, if I could. And thank you very much for the spreadsheets. Very helpful. Yeah. You brought something up that brought up an issue for me. A number of years ago, a business that I own, and in fact, the other Senator George is a partner in, we looked at a facility that had a spur off of a short line and had quite a bit of warehouse space, 100,000 square feet of warehouse space. And what we looked at is, in addition to some of the operations we wanted to do, we were looking to maybe work with one of the short line that had their spur for a cross-dock facility. And when I talked to the railroad, we met with them two or three times before we made our offer on the property. They were very, very much encouraging us to do so because we could unload onto the system on the short lines and then get it into the main the main system. Unfortunately, that project didn't go forward. But one of the things I was kind of amazed at is I asked, "Well, why don't you have more cross-dock facilities available?" And one of the things they said was that there wasn't that many facilities that had a spur or had warehouses next to the short lines. And so what you said earlier sort of brought up my mind. Are you working with the Department of Transportation, working with the LCDC, Land Conservation Development Commission, and some of these about zoning in and around this infrastructure to make sure that we have zoning? If you're going to build a short line that goes out, we're going to have to build it 50 miles down the road just to service one facility. If you had zoning that was compatible all the way along the line, you could enhance that asset that we have if you had planning and transportation planning working together. And I was wondering if the state land use system has been at all brought into the conversation about whether or not they can be more flexible about allowing flexibility of uses around our short lines so that we can enhance and perhaps bring more business to the short lines. And I was wondering if that's been any part of the conversation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator George, yes, my department works with DLCD on a lot of issues, and land use comes up in all transportation modes.
Right.
My experience in just the 4 years, well, almost 4 years that I've been with the rail division, is that we're actually going the opposite direction with industrial lands and, you know, sort of the gentrified, you know, multi-use residential stuff. And in fact, we've weighed in a couple of times in a couple of areas, you know, with different cities planning that we're thinking about it, saying, time out. This particular big thing is industrial. Now, I know you're talking about just along sporadically on rail.
Any of that.
And you know, you've got that even locally, some issues. You know, I try to get people to understand that you've got to protect the industrial lands for the industrial land's sake, because they serve a huge part, and you don't necessarily want that in your residential. And mixing pedestrians in with heavy industrial doesn't necessarily work very well, and people don't really like the smell and the sound of trains and things. So, yes, we do to some degree. Yes, there's, you know, even in our transportation plan that the 20-year vision talks about land use, et cetera, we do. And from time to time, we have weighed in when we knew that certain cities or towns were considering changing something from industrial or starting to allow it to be less industrial and put some condos or something. The problem is, you know, a lot of the rail lines were here, and then we started building up around them. So now they're in the middle of town, you wanted to move, or they're along this beautiful strip of river, and you'd love to put condos there, but you got industrial land there because, oh, by the way, there's pipelines there and barging and everything else. So you're right, it is a conundrum of how do you develop the really pretty stuff and yet not lose your industrial. And yes, we do work with them. And I do work with economic development a little bit to understand where the shovel-ready sites are. That was one of the things we looked at even with Connect Oregon, too, were people putting things, and even on Connect One, were things being built on shovel-ready sites. When I did the industrial spur money, we looked for where could we put spurs on shovel-ready sites or something where there somebody had a project that would do something like you're saying with the warehousing and all. So, yes, we do.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if I could, I just think that's one of the things that I look at this infrastructure and I recognize the importance of it. At the same time, we got to make sure that we're maximizing each dollar that we spend, and I think the land use aspect of it is going to be very, very important. So,
thank you. Thank you. We'll go to Senator Gary George and Senator Johnson, then we'll adjourn.
This is more of a comment. I was just thinking about all the things that have been said, and if you build it, they may not come. But if you don't have it, they're not going to come, period. You've got to have that infrastructure. And then back to your statement is, what kind of a message are we sending out from this state relative to infrastructure? I think, as Roger indicated and as Kelly, you said, is that we have to send a message that we're willing to step up and actually improve our infrastructure in order to have industry come and locate here, or, as in Coos Bay, stay here. Mm-hmm. And you know, Roger, I believe in the House, I think it was you that made the comment about the ports that were about maxed out on the West Coast in ports. We have a port sitting down here at Coos Bay that all it needs is some infrastructure, and it could become very viable. And, you know, when you look straight out east from Coos Bay and you're looking at Ontario, they can connect back there with another rail line. You know, other countries are thinking in terms like that, but are we thinking in terms like that? Are we willing to even, as you say, Mr. Chairman, even consider talking that way? I mean, maybe that's just too radical.
No, I hope that's a very good point. I mean, infrastructure is what's going to drive our economy, and economy is what's going to make all the other wonderful things we want to do possible or not possible. So you're very accurate. Senator Johnson.
I just feel compelled, because it was such a great setup, to add that every single comment that Ms. Taylor just made about railroads, you could strike out railroad and put in airport. Hillsborough is Exhibit A in how we have failed to plan to protect our airspace around airports. Mm-hmm. The other thing, Mr. Chair, I would be more than happy to utilize another mode of transportation if the committee wanted to move around the state, go down and see what's happening in Senator Verger's district. I would be more than happy to host the committee on a little field trip.
Great. Well, I think those will be very valuable for us in the interim, especially as we build our transportation plan and making sure that we are connecting. Thank you for the committee. Members, we are not scheduled to meet tomorrow. This may be our last committee meeting, but just for technical reasons, we'll just adjourn at the call of the chair, and hopefully, as much as we all love each other, we won't be meeting again. We're adjourned.